Matthew Broderick gets a parade and then a decade later fights with Jim Carrey over Cable. And Jack Black wrestles in Mexico this week on 30-2010.
30-2010, here we go again. Analyzing decades, sitting with our friends, those with different days. And there's so much to say.
It's time for a new episode. Not saying welcome, everyone. It's time for a new episode of 30-2010, your weekly look back at what happened in pop culture this very week. 30 years ago, that's 1986. 20 years ago, that's 1996. Mm-hmm. And 10 years ago, the hellscape we call 2006.
That's a spoiler.
but I'm one of your hosts, Brett Elston.
Chris Antista.
Henry Gilbert. Hi, no jokes.
I should have had a joke. Chris Antista playing Mortal Kombat with a friend in Vietnam. It's a reference to 96. We'll get there.
Okay.
All right. I'm Diana Triple Indy Goodman.
And, boy, this is for June 10th through the 16th. Mm. We always take a look at that exact week. That's a seven-day period. So kicking off right away, rather big week for movies.
Awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Especially this particular film that I know Chris
Adams.
Loves.
Oh, we're going to start with this.
Adam Lee.
The first
here.
Name.
Adamowski. Adamson.
Here.
Adler.
Here.
Anderson. Anderson.
Here.
Bueller.
Oh, boy.
Bueller. Bueller. Bueller.
This is probably in my top 10 to top 5 movies ever made. This movie's great.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yep, Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Released 30 years ago this week,
mm-hmm.
I think June 11th or June 13th. I got conflicting dates on
it's
what
being
day
reported
of the
different
week.
Everywhere on the internet, yeah. Including 2 weeks ago when I was watching Adult Swim. Ferris Bueller turned 30 years. You're getting ahead of yourself, and I know this Adult Swim.
Yeah, I don't. I liked this film. I never loved it. I think because I identified more with the older sister in this than with Ferris.
Well, I was going to get to that later. Ferris is a likable character and kind of the crypt keeper to this Tales from the Crypt episode because he has no arc. The real arc is Cameron.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Jennifer Grey. They're the characters who have movement as people.
Yeah.
Ferris is exactly the same
yeah.
place.
The older I got, the less I like him.
Really?
Yeah.
Because
especially at this age, I'm like, you ask everything of everyone, get it all for you. No one, like, everyone has to pay for your mistakes, and then you got a fucking parade.
Yeah.
This is so angry.
That's all
you
out of order.
You take and take and take, and you give nothing.
Yeah, it gives almost nothing back. Except when it's like, when you're completely up against the wall and you have no choice but to show remorse, then you're like, oh, I guess I was kind of a douchebag.
There's a tiny bit of smarm in it. It's just...
Tiny bit.
There is. I'll cop to that. But the idea is, and I was just reading this quote from Matthew Broderick when he was asked why there wasn't a sequel, because they had talked about it, and what ultimately Ferris Bueller is about, and I think people forget that... it's that we thought a sequel to Ferris Bueller where he'd be in college or at his first job and the same thing would happen again, but neither of us found that very exciting hook because the movie is ultimately about a really singular time in your life because Ferris Bueller is about the week before you leave school.
Yeah.
And trying to live the rest of your life. Like, a kid with the foresight, that's my only real problem with it. No kid I knew had the foresight to know, we'll never have this again.
Yeah.
We have to take advantage of it.
Well, that's why he's a magical kid who it can really only be written by somebody 10 years older who's just like, I wish I'd done this.
But it's still the perfect movie for adults, for kids. I love it. Every adult is an idiot. It's all awesome.
It's fun. It's a really funny movie. I don't want to bag on it too
much.
It's
so funny, and it's just like it's wildly wholesome about kids just doing, like, let's just do everything we can think of in Chicago. And I love John Hughes' quote on it. He said he made it as a love letter to Chicago because quoted by him, Chicago is who I am. Mm-hmm. And as a result, Hughes was filming outside. He said he was filming outside for like the first time in his history as a director because he's mostly inside of a school the entire
time. It's
much
cheaper to do that than to, you know, go to a Cubs game and film people in the stands.
Yeah, no, I have 100% empathy for the older sister because I am an older sister, and, you know, just naturally sort of feel like, yeah, you're right. Why does he get away with shit? Why don't I get away with shit? Yeah. I do what I'm supposed to do, and he gets everything good out of it.
I know now.
And that's, I mean, a lot of that is kind of like it's a fallacy of being an older sister. But.
Yeah. As I get older, I don't resent my sister for this, but I got to make all the mistakes, and she got to see me do that. Mm-hmm. And she got to be a better kid and get all the babyish attention. Whereas I got in trouble, she's like, "Ooh, fuck! I'll never do that." Now I know.
I miss Jennifer Grey's old nose.
Yeah, me too.
I wish she hadn't done that. It also had character to it.
The first film of Charlie Sheen.
Yeah,
I love this. I never thought of it until it was pointed out during his. Was that like 5 years ago now? His whole Tiger Blood bullshit, or like four years ago?
Yeah,
when that happened. When people were writing about his seeming self-implosion and seemingly he was like, well, he'll be dead in a week, we were thinking then. People mentioned that his first ever time on film, his like first appearance in a movie was in this film.
Drugs.
And his first word is drugs. The first word he ever says in a movie is drugs.
So because you prepared a few clips here.
It's whatever you want to do. I have
called Cameron.
So Cameron is my ultimately the character who I did connect with.
But
the movie is almost about Cameron.
Sure.
And,
who has
this friend who has everything going for him.
That's the internet fan theory now that it's all in Cameron's head. He makes up a kid named Ferris.
I wouldn't go that far. But
that's a lame.
It is about Ferris Bueller, a very comfortable kid in his own skin. And kids, you'll know if kids under 20, you'll know Ferris Bueller's Day Off by the sting in Deadpool.
Yeah,
that's what it was referencing, and it was amazing. I really hope young people got
You'll get
that.
A lot of Family Guy jokes if you watch this now. Yeah, it was referenced 80 million times on Family
that
Guy.
That Cameron is a guy being. Kind of having to be forced into accepting and challenging every situation his entire life. And it's kind of the best part of the film at the end where he has this revelation. I love this sequence. I truncated like 18 seconds or like 45 seconds of audio of just a car vrooming.
Oh, I'm
bullshit. I put up with everything. My old man pushes me around. I never say anything. But he's not the problem. I'm the problem. I gotta take a stand against him. I am not gonna sit on my ass as the events that affect me unfold to determine the course of my life. I'm gonna take a stand. I'm gonna defend it. Right or wrong, I'm gonna defend it. I'm so sick of his shit. Can't stand him, and I love this goddamn car. Who do you love? Who do you love? You love a car. Bitch.
Love this sequence, him trashing Alan Ruck trashed the dad's Ferrari.
He's been so careful the whole movie, and now he's like, fuck you, car.
He never drives it. He only scrubs it with a diaper.
I mean, Alan Ruck fucking rules in this movie. Like,
he would later be the
good.
Captain of the Enterprise B in Star Trek Generations.
Yeah, he gets immediately upstaged by Kirk and wets his pants in front of the
old
man.
8 years later, he'll be the guy in Speed who says, I've already seen the airport.
I love Ruck. I think, though, too, Sloane is quite a girl.
Mia Sara.
Yeah,
from Legend we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And the scene in there's so many beautiful scenes in it. There really are.
It's a scene of comedic visionettes, and unlike a lot of every other John Hughes, maybe Weird Science, it's shot like a cartoon. Every situation
Weird
is cartoonish.
Science is really balls. Like, that movie.
It does not hold up very well. But this one does. And, like, I even have this quote of, like, this was said by Find the Joy in Life, because as Ferris Bueller said on his day off,
so is high school. Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
That is a quote from Barbara Bush, and then she responds to the audience's applause. I'm not going to tell George you clapped way harder for Ferris than you did for him when he came up. Because that's how important it's in the National Library of Congress. It has Fathom events like once a year. I think it's a beautiful film. It can be enjoyed by anyone.
I think it's good. I mean, as much as we were saying that, Ferris is kind of a dick, I think the reason he doesn't come off as super smarmy is he's very clever, and he does so many different things to cover his tracks. You know, he's got the doorbell, and he's got the dummy, and he's got, you know, fixing his grades and all that stuff. But he doesn't sort of, like, wink to the camera and give, you know, finger guns and be like, aren't I a stinker?
Yeah.
There's a little bit of that.
I think,
but mostly it just kind of happens.
There's a lot of that for a young boy to latch onto, and I did not, to clarify my position, I didn't see this movie as a kid. I saw this movie for the first time when I was 17.
Wow.
And then I watched it every week after that. I loved everything about it, though. But
him and Kevin McAllister are cut from the same cloth.
Yeah,
a little bit, except that, like, this is... But what
Home Alone.
They both live in mansions, yes.
What ultimately the movie is about, it's a very simple message in a shelled in a wonderful cartoon to just, dude, really live your life, especially right now. And it's a great... It'll never not be a great message to send to young people.
Take the occasional risk. Fuck
totally. Like, fuck school. Go to a museum. Go to a Cubs game. Go try and eat at a fancy restaurant even if you can't. Prank call your teacher. And this is just my favorite scene in the film. When I do my rich guy impression, it's partially Dana Carvey from Wayne Gretzky's episode, Jim Backus from Mr. Magoo, and Thurston Howell III, Gilligan's Island, but it's mostly Cameron. Somebody calls in to say we need to pull Sloan out of school, and he's like, it's Ferris Bueller, I know it. And then Ferris calls in, he's like, oh shit, I just told this guy to fuck off. And I love Alan Ruck talking to the principal, who is Jeffrey Jones.
Mr. Peterson? No, I think I owe you an apology, sir.
Well, I should say you do. Well, I think you should be sorry, for Christ's sake. A family member dies, and you insult me. What the hell is the matter with you, anyway?
I really don't know, sir. I mean, I didn't think I was talking to you. I thought I was talking to somebody else. You know, sir, that I would never deliberately insult you like that. I can't begin to tell you how embarrassed I am.
What? Pardon my French, but you're an asshole.
What?
Asshole!
You're absolutely right, sir. You've hit the nail right in the head.
Find out where she is.
This isn't over yet, Buster. Do you read me?
Loud and clear, Mr. Peterson.
Call me sir, goddammit.
That whole sequence is one of the best comedic sequences I've ever seen. To Ferris slapping the phone out of his hand, to handing the phone to Edie McClurg as she has to try to be Mr. Rooney first. It is so funny. That is one of the funniest sequences ever. And then it gets tied up again. The fucking restaurant scene, which I also have for...
Yeah.
Hello, may I help you? You can sure as hell try. Hi, I'm Abe Froman. Party of three for 12. Is there a problem?
You're Abe Froman.
That's right, I'm Abe Froman.
The sausage king of Chicago.
Yeah, that's me.
Listen, young man, entre nous, I'm very busy here. Why don't you take the kids and go back to the clubhouse?
Are you suggesting that I'm not who I say I am?
I'm suggesting that you leave before I have to get snooty.
Snooty?
Snotty.
Snotty?
Every second. There's just every... The movie doesn't linger on anything. It's like...
Yeah.
I love every sequence in it.
I guess it's weird to talk about Jeffrey Jones.
Not at all.
Well, he had some unpleasantness, but he's so damn good in this. He can do a slow burn.
That's great.
Him and Charles Grodman are just the best at slow burns.
It's the best. I don't care how many kids he fucked. It's awesome.
He didn't fuck.
I care about that.
He didn't fuck any kids. He took... photos of someone who is underage.
And I mean, I love him as an actor too. Like on Deadwood, he fucking rules. Like he's so great. But I think. Also, this started the thing Save Ferris, which would later be a band in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Boy, would
it. To for me, its impact recently on my Instagram. I posted some pictures going to the SF MoMA, and it went to Facebook. And like everybody's comment from every age bracket was just a reference to Cameron staring at the painting.
Yeah.
To that wonderful Dream Academy song.
Yeah. The soundtrack.
Soundtrack's pretty all right.
Soundtrack of the Generation. Well,
I did see Yellow's Oh Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the Flower Pot Men song that opens up the landscape of Chicago when they first drive out of the school in the stolen Ferrari.
Yeah.
But my favorite one is that when did they stop using Beatles songs in movies?
Yeah.
And they use Twist and Shout.
Right around this time. Yeah. We're pretty close to when Michael Jackson buys the
Twist.
Is that what happened?
Yeah.
And Paul McCartney said he hated it.
Yep.
If we wanted all the brass in there, we put brass in there. And John Hughes is like, I love you and I'm sorry, but it's a parade.
Yeah. And it's also Twist and Shout is a cover. They yeah. didn't even
yes,
do like,
what do you care?
Like,
yeah. Yeah. But also out this week, and it was also number one.
Done.
Oh, wow. Do you think Cameron's dad kills him when he gets home, or that like?
Oh, I did. Mm. I had to think really hard about it.
I think there's a fist fight, and the cops are called.
Okay. I think his dad is probably like. If I've seen this sort of happen before with certain parents like that, I bet he'd be so shocked that Cameron ever stood up to him in general that he wouldn't know what to do. And I did see this. That home just sold for $3 million. It's somewhere outside of Chicago. It's a beautiful home.
Mm-hmm. But the way the dates work out, 10th to the 16th, Back to School is both number one and came out this
somehow
week.
Somehow released, I triple-checked this, came out 2 days before Ferris Bueller.
That's what I saw. It seems like Ferris might have come out on a Wednesday, and then Back to School was on a Friday. And you have a clip, which I don't know if this is a...
I can set it up, there's a couple of good clips.
It's a Rodney Dangerfield film.
Rodney Dangerfield, like, I hope...
His only good film. I'm sorry. Except for, Caddyshack.
What about Rover Dangerfield?
As a trivia point, they literally use footage from Caddyshack in the opening montage of this. Because Rodney Dangerfield is one of those few men who needed stunt doubles to run. They put him on a car, TJ Hooker style, film up and pull him as he pumped his arms.
Jesus.
This is a movie where Rodney Dangerfield goes back to school to help his son out. But it was also one of the... Probably the most notable film role of Sam Kinison, really hot comic that burned out real fast. But the stories of Sam Kinison's film legacy of him like really screwing over people, not showing up, quitting in the middle of film. This is like his only theatrical appearance ever.
Yeah. That's what I liked about Dangerfield, that he would always in his even awful films, he'd just be like, "Hey, you're a stand-up.
You're my friend.
Be in this movie."
And as a result, he showed up to this, and like it's one of the other than appearance by one of my favorite authors, Kurt Vonnegut. this is Sam Kinison's part in the film. I love it.
Now, can someone tell me why in 1975 we pulled our troops out of Vietnam?
The failure of Vietnamization to win popular support caused an ongoing erosion of confidence in the various American but illegal Saigon regimes.
Is she right? Because I know that's the popular version of what went on there. And a lot of people like to believe that. I wish I could, but I was there. I wasn't here in the classroom, hoping I was right, thinking about it. I was up to my knees in rice paddies with guns and Edwards going up against Charlie, slugging it out with him, while pussies like you were back there partying, putting headbands on, doing drugs, listening to the goddamn Beatle albums.
Oh, that guy.
It's such a dated clip because he's a professor. He ends up bonding with Dangerfield over their opinions on the Korean War. A bunch of shit I don't understand at all.
About what? I have no idea.
It's also notable for being Danny Elfman's second role as a film composer at following Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I don't think it was something he was actively pursuing. He'd scored his own film with his band Oingo Boingo. So Oingo Boingo appears in the film. To perform Dead Man's Party.
Yeah, I only know this film from watching. Like, I think I've watched all of it just through like multiple tuning into it on Comedy Central.
Well,
but like Robert Downey Jr. is the snob in this, right?
Yes.
To the slob.
No,
he's a good guy.
No, he's the son's best friend.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right.
He's his weird spazzy best friend.
He's the nerd friend.
Yeah. I love his thing. It's like when they're signing up for classes, he's like, well, I got Latin and I got ancient Greek, but I couldn't get into Sanskrit. I had this whole ancient dead languages theme going and they ruined it for me. Like, that's such a random joke.
I should have gotten a clip from Elfman's score because it essentially also ended up scoring every single 90s comedy in the early 90s. Dun, 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 boom.
Well, yeah, the studying montage music, that gets used all the time.
You've heard it a billion times. And it's Danny Elfman's second time around as a fucking film composer.
I also remember as a rich kid, as a young kid watching it, seeing how silly it was, like even a triple Lindy, the stunt man they have in it for him, it's just like it's so ridiculous.
No, it is so much fun. I realize it's co-written by Harold Ramis, and I want to say it wasn't written as a Dangerfield vehicle, and that might be part of why it works so well.
Because I'm trying to think right now, off the top of my head, who is a singular. Rodney Dangerfield has a great history if you've never looked into him. A man who became famous on a worldwide level when he was approaching his 50s.
Yeah.
Can anybody think of another movie, a comedy, starring a single 60-plus-year-old man.
Yes.
We just lost the voice of Scrooge McDuck. I want more elderly leading people.
And his love interest is the...
Sally Kellerman.
Salad Kellerman dressing.
Yeah. Oh, she's so funny, though.
On a lesser note, two other movies, Manhattan Project.
Oh, wait. No, not totally. That one, who cares?
John Lithgow, about the
bomb.
Mona Lisa.
Yes.
Don't remember this one.
Oh, no. Is that Bob Hoskins?
The Bob Hoskins movie. Yeah, I watched this last night because this has been on my list for a million years to watch.
That's really good.
It was in the British Film Institute had a top 100 list a bunch of years ago, and this was on it. And I was like, fuck, I got to watch this. Mm-hmm. I love The Crying Game, which is the same writer-director.
Neil Jordan.
Good Friday.
Watched this last night, and I was like, holy shit, this is so much like The Crying Game. Did no one mention that at the time? But Bob Hoskins is fantastic.
Yeah, I remember getting really pissed off when he died. Just like, Bob Hoskins, watch him in that Jet Li movie in Super Mario Brothers. Like, dude, Bob Hoskins is so fucking awesome in like real movies.
Yeah.
Please go watch The Long Good Friday and Mona Lisa to remember him, and I don't think anybody did. Roger Rabbit's great.
And Roger Rabbit.
He's fine in that.
Mona Lisa was wonderful. And it's so weird, like there's so many scenes where, because it's him, he's driving around this like high-class call girl, and then he's talking to Michael Caine, who's a crime boss, and everyone is a foot taller than him.
Yeah.
He's just this tiny little pug of a man, but he's still just fucking up people left and right.
Yeah, like his American work, you don't understand how scary and imposing Bob Hoskins can be in these crime roles. Like,
I can't believe it.
I love him as that kind of like British dog pug stereotype, archetype. Yeah. I guess
there's a line in The Long Good Friday. He's like, he just punches it in the face. You gonna tell us what we want to know? I'm gonna put some muck on the ceiling. He puts a gun to his chin. Like, that's great,
Mario. Everybody.
I think my favorite Hoskins attack in this was like some guy starts bothering him, and he headbutts him, but he has to full-on jump to do it. He just sort of just takes a couple of steps and runs out and just jumps and headbutts.
As like, I said, Bob Hoskins felt like the only established British actor who wasn't in Harry Potter films. Mm-hmm. Like that,
he was kind of suffering at that point.
I loved it though.
Super obscure movie that this
And there's like no information on this. I've seen this in a theater. Yeah. It's never been on DVD.
Yeah.
This is
one of the first movies I ever saw in the Castro Theater here.
What's that?
I've never heard of this. Never Too Young to Die.
Yes! American Hero.
The new American Hero.
Go!
John Stamos is Stargrove.
Stargrove!
Vanity is Donja. Simmons is Ragnar.
Yeah!
It's also
Never Too Young to Die. Rated R.
Never Too Young to Die.
Oh, my Lord. This is a great one.
This is one of the most insane movies I've ever seen. And it being the first thing I saw in the cast, I was like,
really fun.
What the fuck? John Stamos, pre-Full House Stamos, as an action
Post-General
hero.
General Hospital.
Trying to be an action star hero with his nemesis.
They're trying to build a young James Bond franchise. This is a first big, semi-big budget attempt to build a young James Bond. Starring John Stamos. And Gene Simmons as a, according to his character, a hermaphrodite.
Yeah.
Wearing a dress and vamping the whole time.
Of course.
Robert Englund is in it.
Vanity.
It's just such a bizarre...
Is it George Lazenby is the dad?
Yes.
It has a James Bond in it.
They get the cheapest James Bond they could get at the time.
Huge bomb. Never been on DVD. I tried to Google it. There's like almost no information except, of course, it's on YouTube in its entirety.
Yep.
Oh, of course, it is.
This is absolutely worth watching. It's hilarious. It's so bizarre, and it's like in some future where there's like no water, and he's like in the middle of a desert, and then he escapes to go fight Gene Simmons. It's just, and he's also like exceptional at gymnastics for some. Like it's such a weird movie
for some reason.
There's a Hollywood Reporter article with Stamos promoting his show that's probably canceled.
Yeah,
Grandfather. And he talks about like he quit television thinking this was his big shot at movie stardom. Everything seemed poised for this to be huge.
Time for me to be a big star now.
Not huge. It wasn't just a bomb. It fucking disappeared. It's gone.
It was a black hole of a film that just disappeared.
Super good.
You saw this at the. Unironic film nights at Castro Theater.
But
no, I think it's totally come back. It's one of those like weird random things that's just so strange that people were, you know, if you got your hands on a copy, it was lots of like, oh my god, you have to watch this. It's so weird.
I'm putting
that's
all
how
this,
I ended up seeing it.
I'm putting this is me officially putting a ton of pressure on like Alamo Drafthouse Films. Like, if you're gonna bring out Roar and Miami Connection again, this movie deserves a remaster. Another look. It is so fun.
It's one of those I can't believe this hasn't been discovered and like just exploited beyond belief.
That there's like the no information on it. Most people haven't reviewed it. It's so much fun.
TV, as Henry will attest, is still a wasteland.
Nothing, I swear to you. I looked and looked and looked. Nothing of note was on American television in 1986.
I can see
week.
There was a weather report.
But, so let's, why don't we turn again to Japan as we did last week.
This is actually pretty important.
The television series Dragon Ball had premiered this year. It had premiered in February that year, but the comic had been going on for 2 years at this point, and it was a very comedic series when it started. Yeah. It was a comedy action show that was began as a retelling of the classic Journey to the West story of, you know, the Monkey Boy, and here's the original theme song.
Super 80s and great. But yeah, not Dragon Ball Z, but Dragon Ball.
Dragon Ball, two words.
Forget it, dates back this far. Whoa!
Oh, yeah. Man, the 80s were correct. But yeah, Goku as a little kid, still like going after the Dragon Balls, ends up fighting Piccolo. Like, yeah, it sets up a lot of. You don't need to watch this to get Z at all, but like, it's still a lot of fun stuff.
No, it's a fun show. It's a fun comedy when it starts. Honestly is very different from Dragon Ball Z. Only by the and Z, by the way, is a demarcation that never happened in the comics. It was for the anime when they do the another time jump, and it really is such a like thematic jump. They just had to renaming it was the right move. But it was always called Dragon Ball as a manga.
Yeah,
and so when it started out, it began as the Emperor Pilaf saga of just them hunting down the Dragon Balls. Him with Bulma, Goku teams up with Bulma, Yamcha. That stupid pig guy. But the Pilaf saga had just ended, so they were already into the start of the original tournament saga. And he was... Goku was training with a young man named Krillin, who was just a weird kid who had a head shaped like a pachinko ball and was kind of like tricking him all the time. That's really all it was. They were getting trained by... the guy taught him the Kamehameha. The old man. Why?
Master Roshi?
Master Roshi. And it would lead to the tournament saga where Goku almost won his first in the every 4 years tournament, but got beat by Master Roshi in disguise because he didn't want Goku to get a big head by winning his first tournament. His name was Jackie Chun. And they always had more time for scatological humor as much as they had for shooting lasers at each other.
Yeah.
Like, it was really rare to even see like panty one shots. And panty shots.
Diana, wake up.
I'm sorry, my vagina fell asleep.
Something that makes it
difficult. It'll be a movie in a few years.
Something that hurt its localization stuff in the first episodes was that the artist Akira Toriyama, who created it, he got a lot of humor out of exposing Goku's balls all the time. Like, he Goku gets naked.
It's called Dragon Ball.
Goku gets naked a lot, and even though he's like 14, he is physically looks like a 4-year-old or something. He is a tiny little kid, and so it's a joke on. There's tons of jokes of like, he should put on some pants. Why does he not realize he shouldn't be naked? Like, it's a very... And then there's also some minorly, like, he grabbed my boob accidentally jokes, as we all know.
And you don't give Jeffrey Jones a pass.
And I don't want to scare anyone else off, but we also have some comic book news. Briefly, we can
thank God.
I believe we actually talked about this a little bit before, but this was the final issue in June, was the final issue of The Dark Knight Returns. This is Dark Knight Returns number 4, which is basically 50 minutes of the film Batman vs. Superman is this comic book.
Yeah.
Like, their big fight is almost panel for panel the big fight in this. And it is, in case you don't know, it is what if Batman had retired and then came out of retirement in a slightly worse 1986, but where Ronald Reagan is still president. Superman is a tool of the government, and that Batman
Stooge.
Is being told to stand down by Superman, and he ain't gonna do it.
But I got the better description is, what if Batman was Charles Bronson? That's what Dark Knight reads
well,
as
though
now.
Though Frank Miller
I'm so
always,
sick of all this scum.
Yes. Frank Miller always said he would have cast Clint Eastwood at the time in 86 to play to play Bruce, and I think he could have done a good Bruce in 86.
That would have been
actually
sweet back then, yeah.
But yeah, it was a
battering
cool...
Battering your head clean off.
Superman and Batman were always friends before this, and Frank Miller says he takes credit for destroying or hurting their friendship for a very long time. They eventually would be best bros again until this shitty movie this year called Batman vs. Superman.
Which we talked about in other shows ad nauseum.
People are sick of it.
Yeah, music this week taking us out of the 80s. On My Own by Patti LaBelle and Michael McDonald.
Oh, this is kind of a guilty pleasure for me, where it's like, I like it, but I also realize it's super, super cheesy, but goddammit, I just like it.
Yeah, my girlfriend and I were just listening to this, and I can't remember why.
It's not a terrible song. Like,
did she die recently? Why were we listening to it? No,
I don't know. Was it in a movie you were watching?
We watched the whole video, and the music videos. Oh, wonderful cheese. Them singing into, it's like the Somewhere Out There sequence.
Yep.
I love 80s duets like that. I love that.
So this came out.
Beautiful.
First of all, I just love Patti LaBelle.
Chuck-a-con
pies.
Chaka Khan Destiny, follow up to I Feel For You, which is the song most of us would know. The big song of that was Love of a Lifetime, which you should watch the video only to see the clothes in the video. And Earth to Mickey is one of the songs on there as well, but not that Mickey.
Okay.
Glass Tiger had the Thin Red Line.
Michael McDonald.
But
Yamo really, be there from 40-year-old version. Such a good Michael McDonald joke. There need be no more. If I hear Yamo be there, I'm going to Yamo blow my brains out. That's so good.
Also, The Smiths, The Queen Is Dead is out. Enemy, the magazine/website. Enemy said, in 2013, they listed it as the best album of all time. It does have, when the song that's going to take us out, There Is a Light That Never Goes Out.
Ooh,
love this song.
I do love The Smiths.
When we come back, what happened this week in 1996.
The double-decker bus crashes into us. To die by your side is such a heavenly way to die. And if the tent on truck kills the both of us, to die by your side, well, the pleasure, the privilege is mine. Take me.
You like Laser Time shows? Then you might like Bonus Time, Laser Time's weekly bonus show exclusively on patreon.com/lasertime. Here's a taste of what you've been missing. But my dad, he's the oldest in the family, so he's been taking care of all this stuff. So he's been taking care of his parents, and once one of them dies, he has the misfortune of going through the fucking old Rolodex of all the old WAPs. And giving them a call and telling them that, you know, one of your relatives you haven't spoken to in 30 years is gone. You wouldn't believe this. I called Aunt Mary. Like, I've never met Aunt Mary. It's one of your grandmother's sisters. She has, like, 8. And I called her, and she's like, oh, Jimmy, you remembered my birthday. I'm like, no. He's like, so I played along for as long as I could. Yeah, but happy birthday. But seriously, your sister's dead. And I feel terrible about that. What am I supposed to do? Not tell her?
No.
Like, I tell you what you do, because she really was excited you remembered her birthday. You owe her a call next year on her birthday. Mm-hmm. And you tell her, because I bummed you out last year.
If she can make it to her
I
next
brought
birthday,
your sister back.
Get Bonus Time, Laser Time's weekly, full-length, uncensored, and ad-free Patreon-exclusive podcast, as well as weekly full-length movie commentaries, wrestling and cartoon video commentaries, physical rewards, the first season of Talking Simpson, and more at patreon.com/lasertime, starting at just $5. You'll help us live, and we'll do our best to help you never be bored again.
The Crossroads.
The Crossroads. One of the many in a long period during this time of sad homie songs.
I love this song. Bone Thugs and Harmony. This song had come out in mid-May, mm-hmm. and I think I just missed it somehow mm-hmm. in all the gathering music information. But Crossroads is number one, and it's been number one, since mid-May. Mm-hmm. Dedicated to Eazy-E.
Yeah, AIDS took him too soon, man.
And won a Grammy. Just a big song, and just was on the radio and MTV all the time.
I watched the music video 8 million times. I remember always thinking, like, boy, the effect of putting Eazy-E in the sky is not a great special effect. But I do like the... There's something about, like, they never made enough of it, like, hood horror or, like, urban horror. The closest thing to it you see is, like, I guess, what, Leprechaun in the Hood?
Tales from the Hood?
Tales from the Hood. Mm-hmm. Spike Lee tried to make more, like... I think it's a good space for horror stuff.
Yeah.
But, and they kind of do that in the music video of having the, you know, death walk the streets of the hood.
There's also a new album from the fall, Carcass and the Blue Nile.
Sure.
But moving into movies, another Matthew Broderick thing. He's going to ask for illegal cable.
Yes.
Cable Guy!
So I've never seen The Cable Guy.
Really?
Yeah, somehow this is one of... Yeah, somehow it skipped me by. Like, I remember waiting for it to come out, and then it did, and I remember reading a review or something that was
reviewers are pissed.
Oh, Jim Carrey's not funny. He's, like, weird, and that's not what I wanted to watch.
I've never watched this either, and it's because I can't stand when Jim Carrey turns it up to 11. When he goes full Fire Marshal Bill, I don't find it funny. I can't.
But that
take
was the
it.
Criticism is that he didn't do enough of that. He was
they actually
really?
Like that.
Yeah.
Well, because he's actually everything I've seen, he's all over the place.
There's a couple great dude. Him beating up Owen Wilson in the bathroom is so fucking funny.
So that movie,
Movie originated, written by Judd Apatow, as a role for Chris Farley, and I think was supposed to have a distinct and different tone because. That I just mentioned the Owen Wilson bathroom scene. He was supposed to kill him. And so partially Jim Carrey's playing an imbalanced and kind of a really
totally it's a
totally
it's
crazy
still a
character.
Very dark movie.
Okay. Yeah, just it's all it's,
I like those things.
It's all over the place. I was a big fan of the Ben Stiller show.
Yeah.
I love Ben Stiller, but Ben Stiller wasn't a star, couldn't do anything, but he could direct and he could get and Judd Apatow got him in to direct this. He has a very small role. I'm pretty sure he was Asian.
Yeah.
And as does everybody.
As a Melendez brother, basically.
From the Ben Stiller show, Janine Garofalo, Andy Dick, Bob Odenkirk all make appearances here.
David
does David Cross, Jack Black, all these people who
it's a Bernstein Gray production, basically. That's why you'll see a ton of Mr. Show people in
it. It's like, Ben Stiller and all his friends, essentially.
That too, but it is don't look past the production company and people knew this about Cable Guy was infamous beforehand of just like his crazy big payday. I believe it was it 15 or 20?
20 million. The most an actor had ever been paid for a single movie,
and it was setting it up for failure because then everybody just thinks like, oh, is this worth 20 million? They paid 20 million for this thing. And critics savaged it. And I think though people were ready for him to fall because he had just been on the rise for like 2 years straight.
I can't think of an actor that was on that much of a meteoric rise ever in my life than Jim Carrey from
Ace Ventura
into The
Mask,
Dumb and Dumber,
Batman Forever.
Yeah.
All those together are just he's the biggest thing in the world.
Mm. I just can't take that kind of humor. There's just something about it just doesn't work for me.
I think this
Ace Ventura, like The Mask, is the one I like out of those the most because it's a cartoon and I can appreciate it as a Tex Avery cartoon.
It's my least favorite.
But Ace Ventura, just doesn't.
I love
it
Ace
for
Ventura.
Me.
I'll watch
it.
Ace
Ventura drives me crazy. When I watch it, I'm just like, shut the fuck up. Can one person like punch you in the face?
Yes,
and say you're the biggest asshole in the world. Like.
Yeah,
that's my problem with two.
Glad Bugs Bunny didn't lost in 1994.
Yeah, it's just too annoying to be funny for me.
Well, this is more subdued. I would call this, except that I watched the ending and it is so fucking preachy and dumb.
Mm. When he basically says, "Don't watch TV all the time."
Somebody's got to kill the babysitter. Falls on a satellite dish. Literally, the television stops being broadcast all over the world, and people everywhere pick up books. That happens in a sincere way.
Bullshit.
It's total bullshit.
What is the clip you?
It all starts because Jim Carrey's a cable guy who shows up late to Matthew Broderick's apartment. He was just broken up with his girlfriend and his friend Jack
played
Black.
Played by Judd Apatow's later wife.
Yes, Leslie Mann. And Jack Black tells him, like, slip him $50, he'll hook you up with, like, free HBO. Mm-hmm. And this is...
You mean illegal cable?
Yeah.
Who told you that? What is his name I wanted?
Oh, forget it.
You're offering me a bribe. What you have just done is illegal. And in this state, if convicted, you could be fined up to $5,000 or spend 6 months in a correctional facility.
Oh, please. No, that was dumb. I was just making conversation. Forget it.
I'm just jerking your chin. You are too easy.
Wake up, little snoozy. Smell the smelling salt.
I'll juice you up.
Fucking love it.
But he's supposed to be insufferable in this.
He's like, supposed to be insufferable and insane.
Gary is in he's supposed to be too much for you.
The way they describe Judd Apatow was describing the script and why he didn't necessarily like the final product. The goal was to make a character that was sadistic and scary because of how much access he had to technology. Mm. Because he offered Matthew Broderick, here, I'll give you everything. And he continues to give him gifts. And when Matthew Broderick says, hey, quit coming over to my house, maybe, or bothering my girlfriend, he's like, "You want? I know way more about you than she does at this point. Yeah. I know what you've done. I know who you slept with."
And they're going to remake this as the iOS guy or the app guy. Yes. So I'm like,
the Snapchat bay.
Yeah. I did like his... I like the karaoke scene too, where he's saying that
Jefferson Airplane, somebody to love.
Yeah, it's a good. There's good parts of this movie. Also, like medieval times has never looked scarier than this film. But
lots of good Star Trek references. I swear, there's enough good scenes in this movie to make it rewatchable. I'm curious to see what a Chris Farley more serious, scary version would look like.
And it did make $100 million.
Yeah,
wow. And then just look out for how many people you now know from comedy are in it. And I think this was kind of seen as a low point for his career. People wondered if he could make a comeback. I think it was like 98 he put out Liar Liar and the world fell in love with him again.
97 is Liar Liar. Oh, 98 is Truman Show. 99 is Man on the Moon.
There you go.
And then it's over.
And I start paying attention.
Eternal Sunshine, and then I don't want to see anything you do anymore, Jim Carrey.
The Majestic, the worst movie.
What about 23, man? Number 23 is everywhere.
Oh, God. Did
you ever notice Dr. Pepper has 23 flavors?
And now he's an anti-vaxxer or something.
Moving on. Also, Moll Flanders?
Here's where I can pinpoint where I was in 96. This is when I worked at a one-screen movie theater that had the more artier stuff. So we had Moll Flanders, and if you remember way the fuck back when we talked about Trainspotting, the UK release, which we got the American one coming up, we had a senior center like right across the street. Mm-hmm. They loved Moll Flanders. Nobody else gave a shit about it. It's Robin Wright. Was she Robin Wright Penn there or just Robin Wright?
And Harry Shearer is...
No.
Robin Wright.
Ned Flanders.
Yeah. Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Freeman does nothing, and it's an adaptation of the book.
He doesn't even narrate the film.
And it's not terribly interesting.
It's a period piece.
It's a period piece.
That was the summer I learned I was Moll Flanders.
Ebert gave it 3.5 or no, just 3 stars. It's fine.
And one whole jaw.
Come on now. TV this week.
TV. All right. Still we're in the doldrums of television, but this was the premiere of a new daytime talk show hosted by up-and-coming comedian Rosie O'Donnell. It's the Rosie O'Donnell show.
She was past up-and-coming, and she was in bad movies.
Yeah, well, she's just been in the movie now and then.
Say that about East of Eden and another stakeout.
So this is June 10th. She was going to be like the new Oprah. That was going to be her thing, and she had quite a first guest on her show.
My very first guest isn't a doctor, but he plays one on TV. Please welcome my first guest ever, George Clooney!
Still hugely popular 20 years ago.
Yeah, he might be the most used first guest on a talk show.
He's happy to be a first guest for his friends, I think.
Colbert, Kimmel.
That's true. He's a cool dude, but at this point he was just ER's George Clooney. Yeah. Though he was still a hot...
Dust Till Dawn's George Clooney.
He was still a hot tamale
then. He
wouldn't
be out of sight for 2 more years. Yeah.
He was still a pretty
One
big
fine
deal
days,
in 96.
George Clooney.
3 Kings?
Though he jokes that Rosie O'Donnell tried to have Madonna to be her first guest, but Madonna couldn't make it, and so he jokes like, I was supposed to be Madonna. Yeah,
this burned real hot for like 5 years. And
it really did. And it was... the other two first guests were Susan Lucci, mm-hmm. who... she loved from All My Children. And at that point, Susan Lucci had yet to win an Emmy after being nominated for 18 years in a row.
Jesus.
And Toni Braxton was a musical guest. All and right. When I look back on it now, I do see it as a very gay show. Like, yeah. I didn't get, I watched yes. it all summer long
she,
its first year.
Was she out?
No. She, okay. she came out when the show ended.
She was like adopting her second kid with a woman who lived in her house.
Yeah, with a woman. But at the time, she kind of had the. She had like fake men, male crushes.
Yeah, she
on
had
the
a running that's, gag about how much she wanted Tom Cruise.
That's which is promoted as Cruise Day because that Tuesday Tom uh-huh. Cruise came.
Tom
Why
Cruise
do I remember this?
Yeah, but
it's a smaller world.
You look back on it now, and it just feels like she picked like, oh, who's a what is a handsome famous man I can say I'm attracted to? Like,
who will likely never be on my show, so yeah. I don't have to deal with this.
But if we could get him, oh boy! But also her band leader was a clearly like very gay man who constantly talked about his dogs. Like John McDee and the McDLTs, like, and they had tons of Broadway people on too because it was in New York City, and so and she also talked about how much she loved the Merv Griffin show. Like that was one of her favorite daytime talk shows, okay. and it was her inspiration for it as a kid. And,
I wonder if I didn't watch.
How long did the show run?
It ran for 5 years, yeah. and mm-hmm. she then left the show for. Greener Ooh. Pastures.
Did
and,
she leave before 9/11? Or
I believe after 9/11, I think. But
oh. Because it, of 9/11.
Could it be part of the 9/11. Conspiracy, maybe? Yeah.
She, saying, follow the money, man.
And she would go to be on The View and act increasingly erratic on that show. She,
no, I really like her, I think. But yeah. didn't she prove, like, behind the scenes, she was kind of a difficult person?
That's what they say. But don't they say that about every powerful woman, Chris?
Barbara Walters, no.
Yeah,
I think they do say that about Barbara Walters and Roseanne.
But I'm saying that because I don't think the show was canceled. Mm. I think everybody wanted to walk away from it because this was super huge.
Yeah, it was super huge. She always throwing her koosh balls around, but I think it kind of like run its course. Like daytime talk shows, Ellen's been at it for quite a while,
years.
But
yeah.
You got some sports news here, Henry. I hope based on the comments, I hope this is correct. Comments on the site are usually Henry pronounced the name wrong, or that team doesn't exist,
or that football player was not that popular.
Right.
Yeah. I'm going to try to be correct here. I double check
the Colorado Witches.
The Colorado Avalanches beat the Florida Panthers.
It's Avalanche singular.
Fuck. They beat the Florida Panthers in game four on June 11th to win the Stanley Cup.
Yay. Damn it. I was hoping to get like Sternley Cup or something.
The Stanley Carp.
In the Sternberg
The flat Stanley
part.
Cup.
Anyway, that's TV.
All right.
Choke on it, you assholes.
Go watch Cable Guy. It's great. It's a celebration of television.
Video games, only because this segment was kind of short and I don't have a precise date for when this happened. Bust a Move 2 came out sometime in June.
Yay.
On PS1 and Saturn. Bust a Move, a.k.a. Puzzle Bobble, a.k.a.
Much better name.
The dinosaurs from Bubble Bobble, the old Nintendo game with the cute Bub and Bob. Only this one is the... You move this thing back and forth at the bottom of the screen. You shoot bubbles up to the top. It's a puzzle game, and then you try to pop the bubbles. Very cute, very fun, and I played a shitload of Bust a Move 2.
One of the few games I can play.
It's fun.
I've always called it the great unifier. Everybody knows who says they don't like games. Like, come play Puzzle Bobble. It's awesome. Like, oh, it is.
Puzzle Bobble is such a better name.
Yeah.
This is one of those boxes, too, that's like... Do you guys know how to market games? But because it's the 90s...
Oh, that classic. Oh, yeah. That's a classic cover.
Yes, the box is, instead of cute dinosaurs, because that's dumb. Don't put that bullshit on my video game. It's the balls, colored blue, hyper-colored balls, like bright colors, with faces for some reason, and their eyes are taped open, screaming.
Yeah.
Because, like, why, I guess, puzzle games
it's
are demanding.
It's still the play it loud era. Like, this is the, like, oh, let's get intense, kids.
But I want you to contrast that with the song I'm going to play us out with, which is couldn't be more Calliope music if you tried. But Bust a Move 2 is some great music. I'll say it's great music. You don't have to agree with me. But when we come back, what happened this week, 2006?
internet and all the ships at sea. This is Diana's Classic Corner. We look even further back into the past this week to see if there is anything worth a watching. 75 years ago this week, June 13th, 1941, is Fritz Lang's Manhunt, starring Walter Pidgeon. I am afraid this is one of the few Fritz Lang movies I have not seen, so I can't necessarily recommend it. Instead, 50 years ago this week, we got a couple good movies. June 15th, we got the surfing classic The Endless Summer. You at least know the poster if you haven't seen the movie. And also June 13th, we have How to Steal a Million, which is a really charming kind of caper movie with Audrey Hepburn and Peter O'Toole, and it's streaming on Netflix right now if you want to watch it. It's a good date movie. It's very cute and sexy and fun. And also 50 years ago this week, June 13th, it is the 50th anniversary of the Miranda versus Arizona ruling, which, if you don't know what that is the Supreme Court ruling in the U.S. that mandates that cops, before they interrogate you, have to tell you what your rights are. Such as, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have a right to attorney. If you can't afford one, one will be provided for you by the court. So why not watch, I don't know, like a cop movie or a crime movie or a courtroom movie, or I was trying to think of one specifically where Miranda warning comes up as an issue, and the only one I could think of is 21 Jump Street. That's actually what starts the plot, is that Channing Tatum can't remember the fucking Miranda warning, which is kind of stupid because they actually read it to you to make sure they get it right. But it's still really funny because you can't fucking think of any of it. And I just knew that off the top of my head because I watch Law and Order all the time. Anyway, that's it for the Classic Corner. Stay classic. I'm literally sweating. That song did not come out this week. But Music 2006, Raiden, that we played last week, is still number one. Chameleonaire. Still number one. We played that last week. But Keane has a new album, Under the Iron Sea. 2004 was their album with Somewhere Only We Know. And that's, again, we'd have to do the show for 8 years before we would ever get to that song. So
I only know that song from the Winnie the Pooh trailer.
Yeah.
I watched it 11,000 times.
It was in a trailer for a movie we'll not barely talk about at the end of this end of this movie segment. That Somewhere We Know song kind of fucks me up still. Mm-hmm. Just one of those like dumb things where you were when you heard it, it just eats you up. Mm. And it's super like
2006, Kissing Girls in a Treehouse, Elston.
No.
Running barefoot down to the crick.
No, it was more like, I'm not doing that. I'm stuck in Hayward, California with all of that gone and I have no one. That's more what it's.
If we started doing Michael McDonald impressions again, and make you feel better.
Is that the singer?
Yeah, Michael McDonald.
Oh, I don't know who that is. Busta Rhymes also. Busta Rhymes' album, The Big Bang, with a lot of guests on it, producing and contributing to it. Rick James, allegedly, from Beyond the Grave. Stevie Wonder, Eminem, Nas, a lot of people contributing. But songs like New York Shit and I Love My Bitch. There are a lot of Busta Rhymes songs I like, but I don't know this era. And Hikaru Utada's Ultra Blue.
Yeah.
You know her if you know your Japanese music. Huge, huge.
Busta Rhymes records with a fisheye microphone.
Well, hey, if you like Hikaru, you should be watching our Kingdom Hearts playthrough. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
She's most famous for doing the theme.
There you go.
Oh, which one? Simple and Clean? Sanctuary?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, she's one of the bigger musicians of the last, like, decade in Japan. Decade plus, I guess.
Though she's a bilingual artist. She grew up in New York City and with her family.
Busta Rhymes has a song called New York Shit.
And so that's why, like, she'll do interviews and she's just, like, perfect Japanese, perfect English. And can just sing in both languages like equally well.
Good. Movies, moving right out of music. Cars is number one, and it will end up with $462 million.
Oh, my. You know,
I think domestically.
Yeah. Made a crap ton of money. But released this week, let's just let the clip speak for itself here.
Yes, he's through.
I am Nacho. Maybe you've seen me on TV.
Nacho!
What a perfectly pleasant movie.
What a perfectly 2006 film clip with a bunch of Beck. Who did score the film, Nacho Libre.
I do like that song.
It was the follow-up movie from the director of Napoleon Dynamite.
One of the few films I hate.
Not the biggest fan of it.
I want to go back and revisit it because before I was like a big Wes Anderson fan. I'm like, dare you rip this off without knowing any of the reason why and lacking all the nuance.
I mean, yeah, that is that director's style. But then to make it's an odd follow up from Nacho.
This is fun.
From Napoleon Dynamite, it's an odd follow up from Napoleon Dynamite.
It's really fun. I think this film is really fun. And Dave was defending it because he loves it.
It's a parody of an El Santo type films of the time, which was the wrestler buried in his mask, famously.
I feel bad that I still haven't gotten around to seeing this because I do. You know, as much as I give you guys shit for professional wrestling, I do love Lucha Libre. It is more fun. I feel like, you know, it's a tumbling exhibition.
Yeah.
And it's more
with occasionally a story.
Well, and the
but not really. The story is pretty much, I'm going to pull your mask off. Oh, no, now you're pulling my mask off.
Well, though, sometimes the stories can get really cartoony, especially in the El Santo films. Like,
the
El Santo films are amazing. I think the one I've only watched all the way through is through the aid of Mystery Science Theater, which is Samson versus the Vampire Women.
Right.
He literally wrestles the devil in that. But so Nacho Libre is... pretty much the plot of King from Tekken, and that he's
jaguar-headed wrestler who wants to save an orphanage.
He wants to save an orphanage, and so he becomes a pro wrestler, played by Jack Black at his most like roly-poly and fun and goofball. And you know, School of Rock 3 years earlier made him a kid star.
Yeah,
not as much as he probably didn't want that. But
do you see how this whole thing ties together? 86 Ferris Bueller, starring Matthew Broderick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Into 96, Matthew Broderick in Cable Guy with Jim Carrey, also starring Jack Black, who then stars in 2006 as Nacho Libre, and the kid playing young Jack Black would go on to play Ace Ventura in the prequel children's films.
Oh my God.
What?
Yes.
Holy shit.
Yeah, Nacho Libre, yes.
There's only five actors in all Hollywood movies.
Life is a rich tapestry.
It's a fine movie.
I saw this on a plane and was like, I normally would never have sought it out, but then it was on and I'm like, I have no choice but to watch this.
It's so weird.
And it was
hard
fine. It was hard to like get the vibe of it.
It was a Nickelodeon film even, wasn't it?
I think so.
No, it had a GBA game to go with it.
He's advertising the crap out of it on the Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards, which we talked about a few weeks ago.
It's only because the director is Mormon and won't make any R-rated films.
Ah.
Am I wrong about that?
I know that the actor who played Napoleon Dynamite is a Mormon. I do know that. But who's the... The Love Interest is...
Penelope Cruz.
Okay, Penelope Cruz, yes, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just weird to think of this as 10 years old, because up until I saw it in the list, I was like, I forgot that even happened.
Yeah.
That is 2006 in a nutshell. but also out this week, another man... Is this when we have this conversation?
Yeah, it has to be.
On the other side of the world, on the wrong side of the law... A new style of racing rules the Tokyo Underground.
How you guys get away with this?
And all the best drivers want in.
All right.
Dude. Holy shit.
The Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift.
Tokyo Drift.
All right. I think, you know, I enjoyed this movie. I think I might just have to check out because I know this is your field of expertise.
Not really.
It's
so
really?
Like, well, like, so the first one, like, so before we get off on the whole Fast and Furious.
Oh, man, this is so much. This is where the chronology becomes fucked.
Yeah. Yep. But Tokyo Drift was obviously 2006, Justin Lin, who's now directing Star Trek Beyond.
Star Trek.
But this is a weird period where, like, the quick version is Fast and Furious 1 was a surprise hit that made a surprising amount of money.
Crazy amount of money.
Also this like weird late 90s movie that happened to be in 2001. So when you watch it now, the stakes are low. They're after 4x3 TVs and DVD players. And then the second one tries
Heroes
to ramp.
Heroes using the word, the F word.
And then Vin Diesel.
Other F word.
Yeah. Vin Diesel thinks he's going to be a huge, huge, huge star and so doesn't go to the second one. Too Fast, Too Furious.
But this,
nobody
this
really
is the big thing. Too Fast, Too Furious. Man, I'm sorry. I had so much prepared to say about this.
All right.
But just there's casual... People are always shocked when I say like Fast and Furious is one of the best popcorn franchises of the last 10 years. And I love them. I hate the first couple. If you want to get a light jump in at 5.
Yeah.
You want a mediocre jump in at 3. want to do the whole thing, jump in at one, but I think one I don't care for, and two really sucks.
Two sucks.
Two and four.
Two and four are the worst.
And I've never
seen four.
One
is just Point Break, so it's fine.
Yeah. Two is where they're like, let's just make a sequel, and it's all CG to make these...
It's really bad.
Hopefully to make these car stunts look impressive, which it doesn't.
It's really bad.
And I had watched this young filmmaker, Justin Lin, right?
Yeah.
Better Luck Tomorrow. He had an MTV help produce. I saw it in the theaters. I really liked it. And like, well, if this guy's going to direct the third Fast,
I'll
go see it.
It's about being an Asian American. Yeah. But the Tokyo Drift is like the low point for the franchise because like, it has the least money, the smallest budget, no stars.
Well, Grimm would argue that in terms of like they get rid of the CG and Justin Lin comes in like fresh out of film school and just like, no, we're just going to like really shoot some hardcore stuff because he did it in
for
Better Luck Tomorrow.
Porn, it's great car
for car porn.
Porn.
So Grimm loves the film because it's like real live action cars doing live action stunts. And Justin Lin started that. Mm. Like I don't know. I feel like it might be an albatross around his neck for a while. But like I don't love this film, but he created this universe. And ultimately, I have written down we're in a glut of comic book films.
Yeah,
this is the most comic book franchise. Period. This film, the third one, up until last year, was the last film chronologically in the series because Justin Lin basically rebooted it, killed the character he brought over from Better Luck Tomorrow, Han, played by, what is his name? Sung Kang. It's his first appearance as Han. He gets killed.
Right.
In the sixth movie, it's revealed that was actually Jason Statham who killed him.
Yeah. Well, I think they liked him so much.
They put him in five.
Yeah. But in terms they couldn't just make it a twin brother. They had to, still the same
Nobody has killed and brought back as many characters as Fast and the Furious but it's has. Just like, played around with chronology.
But yeah, it's just like, the third one has this reputation of like, oh, we're going to start all over, and it's not a reboot, but it's just like it has nothing to do with the old movie, the first two whatsoever. New direction.
Yes.
And then at the end, Vin Diesel has a cameo.
Which he only agreed to do to get the rights back to the Riddick franchise from Universal.
Yes.
Because that was done after the film tested so poorly with people who liked the originals because it had no flavor from the originals.
Right, yeah.
And isn't it great they put him in there because that could be the connective tissue that would be then used in seven.
So miraculously, so comic booky, in the seventh film, he has a conversation with Lucas Black, the actor who plays the main character of Tokyo Drift, who's never been in any of the other movies, and he's the one... who ages terribly.
Yeah.
And only one.
And in this movie, it's just like a kid in America, a 17-year-old who has to go live in Japan.
With
and then
a big southern twang.
Yeah, he's got a real good accent.
A ridiculous accent,
but
by
like
the way.
This movie is like, it's definitely the one that's like, huh?
It's the one that doesn't star Paul Walker until the new one.
Yeah. And the fourth one is by far the worst.
Oh, yeah.
Just called Fast and Furious.
That's
and then,
awful.
But they resurrect someone who's dead and then makes them a spy and then they become... This is the most comic book thing
that,
ever.
Exactly.
So much fun.
But that's why with Fast...
But it was actually a clone who was set here by new moon
so
Nazis.
And that's why Fast 5 is like, if you want to get why everyone loves these movies... Like watch.
Start with five.
I would suggest the first one just to get because it is a great heist movie.
Yeah.
The stakes are super low and it has a great payoff at the end with fucking Vin Diesel in that car, man.
Yeah. Because ultimately, if you love film, like all film, Fast and the Furious is the best example of mainstream high big budget filmmaking you can do. It's
breathless and exciting, and everyone
is envisions like, beautiful stunts, carries them out amazingly, usually in camera. Which is astonishing, watching like those cars parachute out of the sky. Why did you bother to really do that?
Because they knew it would make $1 billion.
Yeah. So cool.
Because people will show up and go, oh my God, they're really doing that.
If you haven't seen the leaked footage of like someone shooting from their window, they're shooting in New York. Nobody shoots anything in New York because it's so expensive, let alone car chases. But this movie makes $1 billion every time. But the leaked footage is just like, here's a car chase. You see two cars kind of puttering down the road.
Yeah.
And then you see like... a parking garage basically diarrhea a wave of cars outside on top of them, and it's shot with a cell phone. And look, I cannot wait for the new Fast movie.
So my favorite thing in the Fast and Furious movies is that
Han.
in the way that it's become more like pro wrestling in that everyone is protective of their characters. And like Vin Diesel, even though the plot should be he loses a fight so it'll be better when he wins it, his character in the most recent one in 7 has to say like, oh, it's like you fought me with weighted gloves. You total cheater. I would have won this fight. Audience, no. My character would have won. Yeah. But you cheated. Like,
but if you want to see...
And then he literally develops superpowers. Like this.
Yeah,
they're
all indestructible. It doesn't matter.
It's so fun.
And what's crazy... if you want to see The Rock give a rock bottom to Vin Diesel through the floor, watch Fast 5.
And then also this character, Lucas Black, had never been in any of the others until the seventh movie.
Yeah.
He is now signed on to all of them. Every comic books, every character who was ever introduced in the series canon might come back, and almost all of them have.
Yeah, it's not a great movie. Tokyo Drift. As a Japanophile myself, I was annoyed that there. I don't think there's one major good guy in the film who's Japanese. Only the bad guy's Japanese. Han is not Japanese.
That's true. Han's Korean. My big problem with it is, like, it was kind of interesting. Like, oh, yeah, he's going to this culture, and they're playing up, oh, you know, it's the foreignness, but they're not making it really stereotypical and wacky. And then he meets basically a magical Asian guy who gives him an unending supply of cars.
Yep.
And says, no, you go race. It's like, fuck you. Han, you fucking race it. What the hell is that? Are you starting a team? I don't know. You gave him like 8 different cars and he trashed every one. And you're like, I'll just give you another one. I believe in you.
Yeah.
Who gives a shit?
That's why I'm genuinely excited for the new
Star
Trek.
Well, you're a white guy, so I guess you're a protagonist of something around here. I guess I want to get in on that. Yeah.
But I think that's
Here's some cars.
Justin Lin, in a nutshell, accepting the suspension of disbelief that the audience will have and upping that every single time in every film. Like, none of that really matters as long as what's on screen is so fun.
It's just like, it doesn't matter the plot. Who cares? It's just beautiful people in incredible situations.
Yeah.
And when they know they're going to make that money, they are allowed to do insane stunts
and
do them as close to real looking as possible. No, and
I
not
love
fake
it. Every time they just like, they still, even in their most recent one, they're like, we need, if we're going to go to this party, how will people know it's a party if we don't show you asses for a whole minute?
I'm not complaining.
Great. I love it.
Asses and Corona. That's how you know it's a party in Fast and Furious. Asses and Corona.
And this is supposed to be a standalone film, but they keep Justin Lin on. He loves the character of Han, played by Sung Kang, so much. He just makes the fourth film a prequel.
Yeah.
And the fifth film is a prequel.
Yep.
And the sixth film is a prequel.
And the sixth film ends with the death of someone in the third one.
Yeah.
And the guy gets out of the car and it's Jason Statham.
Yeah.
Who, 10 years earlier, had apparently killed one of the main characters of the third movie.
It's such a comic book retcon.
Yes, it is.
What happened to Kurt Russell in the seventh film? Everybody comes away, it's like, he died, like, he disappeared like every comic book character. Like, he didn't die at all.
Yep.
No one dies.
No
one
dies.
Then they couldn't be in the sequel.
They couldn't show up for a surprise cameo. Anyway,
Fast Five.
Tokyo Drift is not the one I would suggest, but also the ridiculous cars, the Hulk Hands car. That's like one of the weird scions with like Hulk Hands button. I think it might be Bow Wow's car.
Yeah.
It's just nuts.
The goatee vehicle.
There's so many crazy fucking stunts and shit in these movies. But also The Lake House came out, which is the movie.
You can watch the oldest kid in Home Improvement crash a car in the beginning of the film.
So Lake House is the mailbox movie?
No, it's Keanu Reeves.
Sandra Bullock reuniting for the first time since Speed to send letters to one another through two time and space.
I guess.
Via a mailbox at a lake house.
But this is the one that had the Keen song in the trailer.
And
so it was all over like the radio because people were like, oh, right, Keen. And also Garfield, Tale of Two Kitties came out this week.
Second CG Garfield thing. Breckenmeyer earning that paycheck. He asked me anything with Bill Murray. He admitted that in the first Garfield film, he just did free punch-up because when they handed him the script of what he was supposed to say, he's like, this is garbage.
Guys,
like, I'll make this
funny.
I'm
trying to do my best Bill Murray.
But then in the second one, he's just like, I don't care. Like, I just like,
and that's... I wasn't going to bother getting clipped from this. Fuck this movie. Fuck not everybody involved because it uses some of our finest English actors in the worst ways possible. Tim Curry plays the Prince of the Pauper rich cat that Garfield is mistaken for. I looked at it. This film was incredibly popular. But it's another one of those situations like the audience didn't ask, nobody involved cared, and another one never happened.
Yeah.
Good.
Some CG. We don't need more.
We can do great things as humans, people.
This apparently made $141 million. So off of $60 million budget. So, Bill Murray, Tim Curry, Bob Hoskins, Vinny Jones.
Vinny Jones is in everything. You'll fucking do whatever you want, man.
Jennifer Love Hewitt as Dr. Liz Wilson.
Yeah, that she played Liz. I guess that's who you'd cast.
But TV, let's get out
all
of here.
All right. I apologize, Diana.
Okay.
June 13th, ECW on Sci-Fi debuts.
Okay, I'll be back later. Bye.
No, I need a monkey's
paw, if there ever was one in pro wrestling. Let's hear that opening.
Let the bodies hit the floor.
You're kidding. Wow,
Paul Heyman. That song was really written for wrestling. Jesus Christ.
That song is 5 years old when this show was on the air.
I know. All right, so ECW, in case you don't know, Extreme Championship Wrestling. It's a cliche to say something is the punk rock of whatever, but it was the punk rock of pro wrestling in the 90s before WWF got its attitude, right, and people were giving people the finger and telling them to suck it. They were doing way dirtier, way worse stuff in ECW. And I was one of those hardcore fans that wanted, like, I got to see the hardest core thing that they're doing. This is a crazy shit, man, in ECW. And it was headed up by Paul Heyman, mm-hmm, who was the businessman slash face of the company. Now, behind the scenes, it was falling apart, and they had a TV deal, and then it went off the air. And in 2001, it died, a sad death of being purchased by WWE.
Well, that's the beautiful part of that Paul Heyman documentary, that Vince McMahon was financing the ECW silently as a farming house for, yeah, his own wrestlers.
Using it as a training
place. Financing his own competition because he knew that'd be healthy.
Yeah, because...
And is literally eating.
Because ECW would
just
not...
Just taking time for a snack. Talk amongst yourselves.
So, close it down 2001. In 2005, there's a one night only to celebrate ECW, and it's kind of a reunion show special, but it's not a real show or anything. But it's so successful that in 2006, a year later, they're like, let's rebuild it. Let's reboot ECW, have a brand new ECW. Paul Heyman will be in charge. And they could get it on the Sci-Fi Network, which at the
total
time...
Total audience did, match, by the
what
way.
What the fuck?
Yeah, so the Sci-Fi Network, we could have live ECW programming of Extreme Championship Wrestling. And it is, what I call it, a monkey's paw, is it fell apart from the beginning. Paul Heyman should have been in charge, but really it was like he wrote the show and then Vince McMahon rewrite it and make it worse and question all of his decisions. They were instructed by Sci-Fi Channel to have stuff that would fit thematically on the show. So there was a vampire wrestler. The joke in the first episode was that a zombie wrestled who then got beat up by famous ECW wrestler Sandman. And the other big deal in the premiere episode was two nights earlier, Rob Van Dam, who was the star of ECW originally, beat John Cena, basically the Hulk Hogan of that era, to win the world championship and became the ECW and WWE champion at the, wow, same time. 2 weeks later, him and his friend Sabu will be caught in a speed trap by cops and found with a lot of weed on them. And he will then be suspended and lose a championship. And it was all downhill from there with ECW. And it just became like a shittier version of WWE shows and just a total like destruction of what ECW was. As a fan, it was painful to see. Aww. It lasted for like 4 years until it finally got canceled.
They lost the purity of the fake wrestling.
Yes, they did lose the purity because they went
corporate.
Tell
us more about your fake movies, Diana.
They lost the purity of it. Paul Heyman would be out at the end of the year when he tried to make CM Punk, who would later become a megastar, he tried to make CM Punk the champ. Vince wanted instead a giant burly guy because that's what he's into to be the champ. The entire audience booted. It was the lowest selling pay-per-view of all time in WWE history and killed the franchise pretty much from then on. And so, yeah, this was the premiere of it, though. It seemed all sunny and roses at that point. If you want a complete history of it, I would suggest the OSW Review, the Old School Wrestling Podcast. Mm-hmm. They do like an entire 5-episode series, a video podcast series of the entire history of ECW, which includes this first episode, which aired on June 13th. It shows you just how much WWE fucked it up. Mm. All right. Speaking of fake fights, June 10th was the return of Celebrity Deathmatch on MTV2.
Okay,
so,
I'm back.
Oh, wait, like the after a long hiatus.
Yeah, it was a big hit in the late 90s. Yeah. But then
I only can put
hiatus.
A timestamp on it because when the last episode of Seinfeld aired, it over to MTV and they had Jerry Seinfeld wrestling Tim Allen for primetime superiority.
And then when he got beat up by his co-stars from Seinfeld who were mad that he didn't do another season because they were going to get big money for another season. But yeah, Celebrity Deathmatch was a claymation show where parodic versions of celebrities would fight each other.
It is literally what we do every Monday on with fake wrestlers.
Yeah. NSYNC versus the Backstreet Boys.
Yeah, or the kind of thing that you do at school, like, I don't know, do you think Mr. T could beat up, like, Rocky, the entire cast of Full House?
Yes, yeah. So it kind of disappeared, but MTV2 was deciding to get into the Adult Swim business. They'd already had Wonder Shows in, we talked about some episodes ago. But they are like, no, if we want to really have Adult Swim, it needs to be full animation. And so they bring back reruns of Beavis and Butthead. This is before Beavis and Butthead gets fully re... No, not Crank Anchors, but a show with Jeffrey Ross called Where My Dog's At, which was a crudely animated Flash show where Jeffrey Ross and Tracy Morgan played a couple of dogs walking around in Hollywood.
I never see this.
Wow. It's not very good. But so the premiere episode of the Return of Celebrity Deathmatch, just to date this for you, had Paris Hilton versus Nicole Richie, Bam Margera versus Tony Hawk, and then Bam Margera versus Don Vito.
Celebrity Deathmatch.
In 2006, this would have sounded so epic, David.
I couldn't believe, Diana, you'll hate this. Dave and I, a while back, streamed the game. They made a video game version of it, but they could only put in celebrities who signed off on the project.
Oh, brother.
So it is like literally Carrot Top and, Jesus Christ, I am at a loss.
Mr. T's definitely.
Mr. T, some entrepreneur, not Donald Trump, but like someone like him.
Yeah,
oh, it's awful.
I wasn't there for that stream.
It's made in the Simpsons wrestling engine.
Oh, Jesus. And then on June 11th, HBO debuted multiple things, but most importantly was Lucky Louie.
I love this show.
The series anchored by Louis C.K. This is one, the opening joke from it that I really like.
Why don't you know, Papa?
Because I didn't pay attention in school, okay? I didn't listen in class.
Why?
Because I was high all the time.
Now, the audience thinks that's the end of the joke. But...
I smoked too much pot.
Why?
I didn't think it would matter.
Why?
I just figured my life would come together on its own. But then I met your mom, and you came along. So now I work at the muffler shop.
Why?
Well, it's too late for me to pursue a career now, and since your mom has a job with benefits, I stay home and I take care of you, because what I make is pretty much just a joke.
Why?
Well, the service economy replaced manufacturing. There's no real jobs in America anymore.
Why?
We had good jobs for a while, but it's just because we were lucky and now we're unlucky.
Why?
It's just the way it goes.
Why?
Because God is dead and we're alone.
Jesus.
Okay.
So the critics were really mean to the show, and yeah. I love. I think Louis, he talked about it a lot in that Mark Maron, the famous Mark Maron interview
for like 5 years.
Because I really liked it, because I got it kind of immediately. He just said he liked the Honeymooners, and he wanted a show where there was a natural reaction to the jokes, and like there is an actual audience, and not the appearance
of
an audience.
Yeah, He said he hated modern sitcoms because it was just so controlled. It was about
contrived,
contrived, and it was about comedy writers who hated it.
Their audience
who just wanted to write in a vacuum and just make things and be like, it's funny because I said it's funny, instead of reacting to the audience. And though I think Lucky Louie's problem was that it didn't come out at a time when people knew it was cool to like Louie. It wasn't cool to like Louie.
People who don't read about shows don't know what he was trying to create, so they were just like, this is a sitcom where the audience doesn't laugh every time and the sets look shitty. I love his explanation that the president of HBO called me. He's like, we make the fucking Sopranos. You think we don't notice how our sets look and that it was intentional?
It's an intentional thing. It is a classic, like Honeymooner style, like three-camera sitcom in a very big studio and like that doesn't look real and with real audience reactions, because he also talked about how he wanted the audience to just like, if they didn't laugh, like, I want people to know they didn't laugh at that joke. I'm not gonna spice it up.
I remember the first time I saw it, and I haven't watched all of them, but first time I saw it, I thought maybe it was a sketch show because the quality of the sets was like the same level as like a Kids in the Hall sketch.
But
they were that cheap and slapped together.
I think it was that Louie, it wasn't arched enough. Like, Lucky Louie, like, on the show, Louie it's much more obvious of like, this is intentional. Like, let me show you, like, this is not having a joke for a reason. I cast this woman to play my mother who's like 20 years older than my mother would be. Stuff like that. Well, meanwhile, Lucky Louie was more...
That's what I forgot to... Alan Ruck was 29 when he played Cameron. Anyway.
Oh, holy shit.
But yeah, also on Louie, it was about a... It feels old to me now because you know so much about Louis C.K.'s life through his stand-up that this is about an era of his life that is 8 million years ago when he had one kid and had a wife and was about to have another kid, and it was about the difficult situation between him and his wife, but seemingly they'd always stay together. And instead,
my favorite clip I couldn't find is just the kid being a total asshole, and he just said, she used to be cute, now she fucking sucks. And like, the audience clearly wasn't ready for that kind of joke.
No, and his wife was played by the Pamela Adlon, who is the voice of Bobby Hill and a million other voices. And
if you hear like, fuck my butthole, like, as the, it's sounds like Bobby Hill still, it'll ruin it for you.
Yeah, and that she, I mean, he loves working with her. It's the reason she became his love interest on the FX show.
She is not only, she's a consulting producer on Louie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Dane Cook's shitty show Torgasm.
So I just liked, ironically, that Dane Cook's horrible, dumb, crappy, shitty, wannabe docuseries Torgasm premiered on the same night who Dane, like, famously at the time was known by... fanboys like me as the guy who stole jokes from Louis C.K. and was too popular to be cool. And then it's funny that it premiered the same night as Louis thing. Like, you have to imagine Louis at that time was like, that fucking asshole Dane Cook is overshadowing me on my own.
Then I loved when Dane Cook showed up on Louis though. Later.
That was awesome. I do not hate Dane Cook, and all the comics on the show I believe are fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Gary Goldman, I remember, I just watched his special on Netflix.
I just remember Torgasm being like,
I remember being
when I decided, Dane Cook's... Well, actually, was that movie he did with Dax Shepard before this?
I would not watch that thing. Whatever it is.
Let's not.
Anyway, Lucky Louie, worth returning to if you have HBO Go. I mean, you know, it's not as good as Louie, his current show. But
it's different. And especially if you're watching Horace and Pete, this has to be an in-between, an intentional comedy on a live stage.
Video games this week.
Oh, and he shows his dick to an audience. Like, dicks are shown, and like, do you think the audience will go crazy to a funny joke? Imagine the main character showing them his dick. Like,
showing his dick to a live audience instead of just
They go
insane.
Games this week, not a lot, but one interesting note in the middle here. But MotoGP 06 came out. Normally, who cares? It's the motorcycle racing games that comes out once a year, and everyone's just like, do we have to? And the people who like it. But I remember this because, again, we're getting in 2006, working at Games Radar, doing previews and reviews and stuff. This is one of those previews I was assigned, like MotoGP. You got to. I'm like, I've never played a motorcycle outside of like arcade games. Like, I've never played a simulator. I have no knowledge. And so I just emailed the PR team there, and I'm like, could I instead, like, could you just, like, I'll write a specific feature about this game if you just send me screenshots of just people wiping out. And they were like, sure, nobody writes about this game. Like, if you will write about it, I will say. And they sent me, like, a dozen screens of just wrecks.
That's awesome.
And
that's
just the people flying off of motorcycles. And that's, I asked a guy in our office who rode a motorcycle to work every day. I'm like, can you help me caption some of these? And he kept...
That's who you talk to?
Yeah, and I don't, just to use the word he used, he's like, oh, yeah, I'm a total gotard. And I was like, uh-huh. Well, anyway, I don't want to put that in the site.
Love this man.
Anyway, also at this week...
Because I eventually ended up reviewing those games at some point.
Probably.
I did like it because it was on the... Man, this is stupid. The Xbox Live, it was like a year late coming to the original Xbox, and when it did, it came with a free Tetris Worlds, which worked online, and an online demo of MotoGP. It was like one of the first online games you could use broadband with a console.
Well, the 06 one came out this week, Chris.
Did it?
Yeah.
Boo.
No.
Wait, it's better.
Yeah. This week, notable only because of what they would do later, Urban Chaos Riot Response, or Urban Riot Chaos Response, or Urban Response Chaos Riot, or... Yeah, I'll stop. An FPS that I don't think had any particular standout feature, just a shooter with some stuff going on, whatever. Notable because it was made by Rocksteady, And that is, to date, the only game Rocksteady has made that is not Batman.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
3 years later, they would make Arkham Asylum, and then Arkham City, wow. and Arkham Knight. And
who published it? Were they acquired by Warner Brothers or something?
I don't remember who published it. But
I totally forgot they did anything before Arkham games. Because to me, Rocksteady just appeared out of the earth with Arkham Asylum.
Eidos was the publisher, which makes sense because, Eidos published.
And that's why Square Enix would be the publisher of Arkham. But people don't want to hear about companies being bought by...
Point Blank DS. Point Blank's a great arcade shooter, a light gun game.
Another Square game.
The DS is actually really fun because it's a touch screen, so you could actually do a lot of like tap, 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 tap shooting gallery stuff.
Yeah. Does Starly Marvin...
No.
Well, then, fuck it.
Well, I don't know. I can't say categorically no.
Then I
two
refuse.
Charming Japanese men.
Armored Core Last Raven and Mega Man Battle Network 6.
From the Dark Souls maker.
Yes, From Software making Killing Time Till Demon Souls.
You guys have never heard of Mega Man, though. So
yeah, well, Battle Network was a series I didn't get into, and only after 4 years at Capcom did I finally try Network 1 when it came to the Wii U Virtual Console, and I was kind of like, okay, I get it. I can see why this is fun. And
it was popular.
It was extremely popular in the mid-2000s and early 2000s. And I just kind of, it's like, that's not my Mega Man. I don't care that it's here. It doesn't upset me that but the one I like doesn't get new games.
Me!
What about what I like? I only have 9! but instead, it made me enjoy, I finally gave it its due. And I was like, I never had, I was not a fan of it, but like... Mm-hmm. It's still and then there were 7 versions of Mega Man running concurrently, and a 5-year span of 98 to whatever 02, 03. It's like classic Mega Man X, Battle Network, Legends was finishing up in 2000. Not to mention the Zero series, and then that gets into Powered Up and Maverick Hunter. It's just so much shit going on.
You should have no want for Mega Man games. If you've only played 20, you have 80 more to enjoy.
There's so many.
I did like the first Battle Network. I played at the time.
I was wrong for passing on it for sure.
But it was I think they put out one every 9 months at a certain
time.
They literally Mega Man'd it.
It was a lot. comic books, another real quick note.
We talked about Civil War before, but this is the big Civil War moment. Happened on June 14th. Ooh. It was reported on in the news and everything. Ooh. Spider-Man revealed his secret identity on the last page of Civil War number 2, where it was a big deal. Spider-Man unmasked. It was him putting his weight behind the Superhero Registration Act and outing his secret identity. It was a story to the world. Spider-Man doesn't have a secret identity anymore.
Yep.
Within 6 months, it wasn't 6 months. It was 9 months.
Within a year.
Yeah, it was in a year. Within a year, they retconned it because they wrote themselves into a corner of everybody knows he's Peter Parker.
Yeah, so all his foes, all his many notable villains are going to be like, oh, I'll find that guy and his wife and his aunt, and I'll kill them all.
And they...
Get this phone book.
Yeah.
They
wrote themselves into such a corner, and the way to write it out was... to have the devil take away Spider-Man's marriage from Mary Jane and erase everyone's memory that he was Peter Parker.
First of all, not the devil. Mephisto.
Not the biblical devil.
What does he get
return? So this is one of those things where we must accept this. Because the status quo was so awful that it was one of those things where, as a reader, I'm like, I don't care how you explain your way out of this. Just explain your way out of it.
Get me new stories.
And when they started it with Brand New Day, it was beautiful. It was one of those things where the result was so good, and the comic got so much more fun and exciting in what Spider-Man is supposed to be. After 3 years of dour, sad nonsense that I couldn't hate more. No. Of just every storyline beating him up emotionally and physically. It was Spider-Man's supposed to be happy. Mm. Anyway, the idea is Mephisto, he's like, because Aunt May gets killed.
Near death. Shot and is on the edge of death.
It's near death, and he's just like, I'll save her. I'll make everyone forget that you're ever Peter Parker. I will undo all of this. But because I'm me, basically the devil, I need something precious, and the love that you two have, your marriage, to consume that as a concept will be so sweet to me.
Yeah.
But you two will never remember you were married. You will never remember. You might remember dates. And that's what was also weird about it, is they weren't clear about how much they would
because
remember.
Because they knew the writer took his name off the last book, J. Michael Straczynski. But so they knew it wouldn't make any sense. They pretty much made it vague. So 2 years later, they're like, okay, this is what happened. We finally figured out how to explain it in not the most stupid way ever.
But it's one of those things where, fine, I don't care. I'm glad you did it because the comics that resulted from this were great.
But that all began with Spider-Man's unmasking, which was the major moment of Civil War II. Mm-hmm. It was slightly delayed, and that was the issue getting published was slightly delayed, which really fucked up the entire line because every other book, like the writers were told, Spider-Man's unmasking at the end of this. Write your books accordingly because it'll come out the same week as this, and we want them all to feature it. And then when it came out later, like, we got to push this a week. Like, people can't know he gets unmasked in this. It has to be in that issue.
Oh, geez.
Yep. June 14th.
Thankfully, that issue never came up again for Marvel.
Yeah.
Never again.
Yeah. That's the show. You can listen 302010 at lasertimepodcast.com or on iTunes or on our one of our networks, Wondery.
Wondery.
We have a beautiful page there with all the episodes and little embedded players. You can check it out there. And also patreon.com/lasertime, which is how this show got funded, I guess. You know,
it came into existence because you made it happen.
You guys helped us out. So check out the Patreon. Check out what we're doing over there. But also, there's a lot of other rewards in it for you. But in general, you do keep all of this running.
This was crowdfunded entirely because people, and we don't say this out loud enough, but it's worth appreciating, trusted us enough with the concept of the show because of the strength of our other shows, like Cape Crisis, if you want more comic book talk, and Laser Time, if you want more wrestling, there's always Cheap Popcast, and Video Game Apocalypse, with who, Diana?
With Mr. Diana Goodman.
Woo!
Hey. Love calling him that.
And of course, there's Talking Simpsons, another Patreon-supported thing where we go episode by episode with every episode of The Simpsons. We're deep into season 3 at this point.
Oh,
every episode is the greatest episode ever. It's it's a really beautiful
time. It's really hard.
That brings us to the final segment of the show.
I'm glad you asked about that thing, cause what?
Oh, sorry, that's the wrong song. That's the compliment song. I needed the birthday song.
You're a pretty kitty.
Oh, birthday!
Kitty hair.
Home movies again. The episode of the party. Birthdays this week, June 10th through the 16th. Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen and Kat Dennings were born today.
Whoa.
Born this week, I should say, in 1986. All three of them on the same birthday. I'm really surprised that Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen.
That's a busy hospital.
I can't believe they have
this. So this time in 2006, they were already 2 years past the countdown to them being legal.
God, am I right? Elbow to rip, boner talk.
So weird.
That's pretty gross when I look back on it.
It's pretty gross. Also,
no one should be embarrassed.
Judy Garland.
Yay!
Elizabeth Hurley, Bill Burr, Shia LaBeouf, I think, was also born this... No, he wasn't born...
Do it!
He wasn't born this week, but his birthday is now. Joe Montana, Peter Dinklage, Hugh Laurie, Gene Wilder, Jacques Cousteau. All
right.
Anne Frank.
Yay.
Actually, Anne Frank shares a birthday with Mark Henry.
Wow.
a wrestler.
Mark Henry.
George H.W. Bush.
Right.
Chris Evans.
Her.
Rivers Cuomo.
Right.
Now for the quiz. Born in 1978.
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
Had TV roles on Scrubs and Supernatural. Was in movies The New Guy and Road Trip. Road Trip was the one I thought would really give it away.
Tom Green.
His first name is two initials.
Oh, DJ Qualls.
Yeah.
Oh, Atari guy.
Yes.
Atari guy?
What? He wears an Atari t-shirt. Oh.
And appropriately enough, taking us out will be from the Tokyo Drift soundtrack. Actually, it's not in the soundtrack, but it's in the movie Atari Teenage Riot. The song Speed.
Wow.
Such a great song, but it's in Tokyo.
I love this album.
It's in Tokyo Drift. DJ Qualls. How did we make this connection? Wait, where's an Atari shirt? Man, this is tight. All right. When we come back next week, more about what happened 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago.